This audio is a recording from the Rethinking Revolution discussion series held in Chaumes-Brie. This recording was on How Do We Know Who Will Struggle? This section is the discussion that followed after the talk. You'll find the talk itself on the WSM website at www.wsm.ie. So in terms of questions and discussions, don't have to be questions, you can just say whatever's on your mind. What we'll do is if you've spoken already and you want to speak again, we'll take anybody else who hasn't spoken first to give everybody a chance to speak. And generally try and avoid getting in dialogue with just one person. I'll take people in the audience put their hands up.
Well, I was kind of worried a bit when Paul said I was going to read a quote out from E.P. Thompson that said he's going to put it in fairly straightforward language, and then it started with the historical phenomena, and I was just like, oh, fuck me, I'm lost already. I was saying the E.P. Thompson quote kind of got me lost very quickly, but I think what I found really good from it was this idea of the circuits, and the reinforcement, the way class works is it reinforces that isolation, and that's why they've developed it in such a way so that the top circuit is one where they just continually make profits, and the people who make profits make greater and greater profits. And the people who are on the other side of that circuit are people who just have to sell their labour in some way and continually... Unless, if you stay in that circuit, you stay in that circuit forever. And the gaps widen continuously. And the other thing that I thought was interesting in terms of if we wanted to look at an example of how it works, I think that if you cast your minds back to the crisis that happened in the economy, you might have heard that the minister said at one stage, we need to save the banks. We have to back up all the banks in Ireland. They have to be saved. It's very important. You know, if we don't save the banks, you know, whatever, you know, it's Armageddon. So they saved the banks, and they chose the banks very specifically, the ones that they wanted to save. Then a month ago, there was a bank which is run from the post office. And as we all know, the post office is where you go down and you collect your social welfare and everything else. And it was a bank that just specialised in opening up savings accounts, and it also did, and it was called Postbank. But Postbank wasn't saved. Postbank was closed. There was 170,000 customers using that bank. And so straight away we see, like, well, why do we have to save these banks? And we didn't have to save a bank that everybody uses. And if you look at it in terms of anonymization, yeah, sure, there's like you're just one individual going down and having that savings account in the bank. But if you look at it as 170,000 people had their bank account closed, then, and if they got together, there was a collective response to that, then you would have seen, again, some sort of the composition of class as a relationship, as in a collective response, and it defining the relationship. So the other interesting question would be to ask how many people had bank accounts with Anglo-Irish Bank. Because effectively it wasn't a bank that was working on that basis, it was a bank that was working on the basis of giving out astronomical loans to developers who were at the top side of this mechanism, investing money, making more profits, continually making more profits. That's just what I have to say.
I think we didn't ask too much about, you talked about class and what class is. Seem to be kind of saying that class exists only when there's consciousness, when the composition of class is the same as the arising of class consciousness or solidarity, when people are together in such a situation where they can see that. But so I mean, I think the question of who will struggle, it doesn't necessarily mean, it's not necessarily the working class. Like who will struggle is who will see their interests lying more in changing the system than within the system, and which means not having too much invested in the system already, not having too much to lose, thinking that it's possible to win, having the imagination, or you can only have the imagination if there's examples really that show that it's possible. So, like, and in the struggles that have had some success that we might be inspired by in recent years, it's very often not the sort of classic working class proletariat. In Argentina, it was all kinds of people. It was middle class people, it was working class people, it was unemployed people. And that happened, I think, when, like relating to the Malatesta quote, when the system collapsed and the space was suddenly opened, that people, first of all, had to find another way of organizing their lives to have anything working, to have their means of reproduction, their means of subsistence even. They had to organize it themselves. And the space was there for them to imagine a different way of being together, a new subjectivity, I think. Like this whole language developed in Argentina, in the political struggles in Argentina, in the neighborhood assemblies, in the recuperated workplaces, a whole language of a new subjectivity, they invented new words like horizontalidad, horizontality, horizontal relationships between people. What do they call it? Affective politics, like kind of emotional politics. And that was because the space somehow opened up. Now, so then the question of who will struggle, how can we encourage people to struggle, how can we find people to struggle with, then like how can we create that space rather than just waiting for the system to collapse or something and hoping that when it does collapse people will have the imagination to do something else instead of turning to fascism or something like that. I think that's maybe what we need to look for. Again, like another example that we might be inspired by would be like Chiapas, the Zapatistas. There, it wasn't the working class, it wasn't the proletariat, it was peasants. In Bolivia and Ecuador, it's indigenous peasants again, who are the main people struggling in those situations and finding some success, and inspiring us. So, and David Graeber suggests that revolutions happen usually when you have an alliance between the most oppressed and the least alienated. The most oppressed have the least to lose and the most to gain. And the least alienated meaning like students or artists or whatever. So with either a very exploited proletariat or peasants or whoever. And when these people somehow come together, and that, like, if you look historically, that often seems to have been the way that revolutions have happened. So that's just a few thoughts.
Yeah. I want to kind of echo what you were saying there. I really enjoyed the talk, especially, I thought the way you set up the issues was really clarifying, extremely clarifying, and really important. But I just wonder, is there a danger? You begin by showing how, if we categorize classes through certain more or less objective characteristics, like taxonomy, that's basically how power operates, like the credit rating thing you talked about. Okay. So it's very important to imagine the fact that we share things in a way that doesn't categorize us according to some characteristics. That's a really practical political task. But then, in trying to overcome that, I felt a bit like, although you move to this way of seeing things as circuits, ultimately it comes back to something quite similar, something which is quite a logic of categorization. And I think there's two kind of problems that I have with that maybe you could respond to. The first one is, you try to develop a broader concept of class, but in doing that, you do that by, I think, expanding conflict to include a very, very wide variety of experiences. So in your discussion of the single mother, conflict is basically any difficulty that the person has. And I'm not sure if that's a very political way of thinking about conflict, particularly if conflict is then essential to how you conceptualize class. So I don't know about that idea of conflict as difficulties that we encounter in life, even if they are related to our more or less material conditions. The other thing, though, is, and I think it's more important, is the whole question of there being some, what you said about Tranti, not thinking about things from the point of view of capitalist accumulation, thinking about things from the point of view of the worker. And there's another element of the Italian Tranti workerist type tradition that you didn't talk about, which is how they were inspired by migrant workers predominantly who came from the south to the factories in the north of Italy. And they weren't really interested in the communist party's discourses and ideology and so on. But at the same time, they were engaged in all sorts of kind of practices which interrupted or went against the logic of the factory. But they didn't want to identify maybe as workers, and they didn't want to identify with the idea of work and the whole communist party's fetishization of work. And what Tranti argued there, I think, was that in those kind of spaces, exactly like what you were saying, something new is opened up. Something which is neither worker nor capitalist, but some way of being which rejects both those categories. And this is what I think John Holloway says in that book, Changing the World Without Taking Power, that worker is a worker in the sense of the like really political class sense of the term, is somebody who doesn't want to work. Somebody who doesn't want their life to be reduced to working all the time. So it's a kind of a disidentification with you just being a worker. And anyway, the point we're trying to make is, within the political relationship, like you say, we have to conceptualize class as a relationship, and I agree with you. But a relationship, if it's really political, it has something kind of outside of it, if you know what I mean, an excess to that relationship. If you see everything as being determined within the relationship, and ultimately you see class as being determined within the productive process, you end up coming back to a kind of a taxonomy. A very, you know, or I think there's a danger there. At least that's what I'm kind of wondering about. Is there a danger that if you see everything as being determined by how production is happening, and if you see the relationships as being determined by that, and there's nothing really outside of that, then do you just come back to a kind of a category way of thinking about things, a kind of a taxonomy way that you started out by criticising?
The migrant workers, they would be, I think, simultaneously less alienated and more oppressed. And when the proletariat have been a revolutionary class, has been quite often when they've been recently proletarianized. So they still have a different consciousness from when they were peasants or when they were living their life in a different ways. In a different way, they still reject the identity which is thrust upon them by the factory and by those kind of relationships. And I think also, Paul, you said that the key point of conflict in capitalist production is over wages. That's right, but something that's and it's usually assumed to be the main thing. But there's another point there as well, which is the ownership of one's own activity. I won't say ownership of your own labour, because labour, I think, implies an alienated activity anyway. But ownership of your own activity, to have control over your own activity, to not be alienated from your own activity, to reject that command relation, and that's obviously something that should be a key point of interest for us as anarchists, that we reject the command relationship. And there's always conflict there, because everyone hates being fucking told what to do. Right? Everyone feels like, you know, and if you're in a relationship where your boss is an asshole, where you don't have any choice but to obey them, and you feel like strangling them sometimes or whatever, or just saying fuck off and walking out, and you can't, because you've got to put food on the table or whatever, then that's a key point of conflict as well. It's not just over the amount of wages, but it's over the right to decide your own activity, the right to direct your own activity, to be a human being, and not a component in a machine. I think that's key as well.
Well, I'll just take them in the order I've written down briefly. Argentina, Yeah, the thing is, when systems collapse, they never seem to collapse for everybody, you know? And it's sort of like, who it collapses for and who it doesn't collapse for is usually quite revealing, if you like. So, which brings up the point about middle class. I never answered the question I sort of posed at the beginning, how many classes are there? Yes, there is a pheasantry that I've never met. I'm not, you know, the middle class exists as a form of consciousness of people who think of themselves as not working class. However, when it falls apart, at the end of the day, they still have to sell their labor to live, same as anybody else. If they're unemployed, they're just as unemployed as everybody else. So I would consider middle class consciousness as an element of decomposition of capital, because as far as I'm concerned, the conflict, there's still two sides of the conflict. Even though on the battleground you may have sort of people wandering around not sure what side they're on, whatever, doesn't mean that there isn't still a war going on and there's two sides to that war. So proactive versus passive. I'll pass on that. Peasants, yeah, absolutely. You know, not a lot of peasants in a city like Dublin, but
present company accepted.
But again, peasants come into conflict with the state and with oil companies and want to take their land and so on, and they come into conflict over the circumstances of their existence. You know, forces are trying to take their land away from them. Their land is what they use to make a living. So there's, you know, and that's still a class conflict, if you like. It's a different kind of class conflict than the one that we have because we haven't got any land. But it's still, you know, it's still about the means of their of gaining their living. This is really what comes the conflict comes down to. So I don't have a problem with that. The distinction between oppressed and alienated, I'm not sure I entirely follow that. Let's come back later. The point, I can't remember what it was yourself or we moved to make here, but the example of the single mother being a class conflict being any difficulty that you have. No, you have lots of difficulties that are not part of that circuit, you know, family difficulties, you know, personal difficulties, etc. The ones that I was particularly looking for there is where at each stage in the cycle it brings you into conflict with other people, whether that's the state benefit system and the government over the level of the social wage, whether it was, you know, shopkeepers and catalog owners about whether or not you've paid your catalog bill, whether it's you've paid the milkman, etc. But, you know, so these are conflicts over the means of living that you run into, and schools and social workers, again, you know, it takes two to have a conflict, if you like. And these are bodies that you're coming into conflict with. Again, you can experience that conflict as being something that's just individual. But then if you compare notes of the same people, the people around you in a similar situation, you find out that you're all kind of have the shared experience of being in conflict with the same social bodies and the same body state. So I don't think it's... I wasn't just explaining any difficulties there. The next point... The point about... the circuit doesn't define the whole of life. Yeah, that's quite important. I kind of touched on that when I was talking about how recomposition, really, that as people are brought together through, could be through wage work or through, you know, your kids going to the same school or through social centers or the various things, that as you're brought together, you start to evolve common values that are different from the sort of the so-called capitalist dominant consumer values we're supposed to have. So, I mean, and the word here, I guess, is autonomy, is what we're looking for. So, yeah, I would agree with you totally that, the circuit, we're not simply carbon copies materially determined by sort of those circuits. We existed before them, we'll exist after them, and even within them, there's still an outside, if you like, that we still have an autonomous life and we can have values that are different from the ones that we're supposed to have. So the whole idea of workers against work, and like in Italy in the 60s and so on, where you'd have these wildcat strikes of people who migrant workers coming from the south of Italy who were not sort of enculturated into the sort of traditional Communist Party dominated trade union culture of the north. You know, they'd go out on strike, and the bosses would phone the unions up and say, like, you know, what's the story? What are your demands? And said, well, the unions go, well, they're not talking to us, and they haven't got any demands. They're just on strike. They're like, fuck you. What are your demands? We ain't got any. Fuck off. So that whole concept of workers against work. Yeah, and it's an important one. And it's also, I think, you'll find, if you look closely, though, these so-called alienated workers who all believe in working hard and fair day's work for fair day's pay. In my life experience, actually, they're kind of few and far between. You find a lot of places where you've got a certain stability on the shop floor where people have had time to build up a degree of control over the process and their own culture. You'll find a whole load of like, yeah, we're not doing that, fuck off. And controlling the rate of, trying to gain control over the rate of work to slow it down to a pace that's, you know, sort of steady away, as the saying goes. In fact, I love that saying, steady away means not too fast. So I think that, you know, that whole culture of working class resistance and autonomy is sort of there. It isn't just people who've been nearly ripped off the land and thrown into the factories and so on. I think it's always there to a certain extent. It's just, obviously, nowadays we're faced with a lot of workplaces which are very precarious. There's a huge turnover in staff. There are muck jobs or something like that, and it's quite hard to get enough traction, if you like, for stability to start to assert a bit more control and some alternative values. But that doesn't mean that it's a rare thing by any means. Yeah, I'm not really sure where you got the idea that key point conflict was over wages. That was sort of the idea of picking the example of a single mother was to make the point that it, you know, it's not just over wages at all.
Anybody who didn't get a chance to say something already want to throw something in?
My brother was saying about peasantry, Latin America, and in the context of today's talk is like who is struggle. I don't think those examples are particularly useful for us in Ireland. The way society is formed, I don't think it could give us good examples. And if you look at like peasantry, yes, there are some. The percentage there in this country now is like, I don't know, it must be less than 20%, and probably less. Most, and it's not, peasantry is not people who live rurally. If you look at who lives rurally, a lot of the people who live rurally now actually work in various different places. But the amount of people who work on the land is just going down. So that model, I'm not sure, is particularly beneficial for us to move forward from. And in the context of who is struggling in this country, I don't think is, and that's in the context of, like, I have a lot of time for people in the life. Or the way life in the country is being ground down, but like it's just in the context of your story, it's not sure how it's going to be it. It's really where the horse is at.
Well, given it's whose life is a struggle, I think there's another side to coin. The struggle never stops, it's just that the other side are making all the running at the moment. Like, the ruling class have us on the ground. We've had wage cuts, dole cuts, you know. Practically everybody has been hammered in some way or other, and they're continuing to get away. It's like, struggle isn't something that switches on and off. It's more a question of, is it our side or their side that's making the running? And I think when we talk about class, I don't know if it's an Irish thing or it happens all over the place, I think there's often a tendency to sort of make things a lot more difficult than they are, to try and turn it, I don't know, into some sort of university course or something. But as I would see it, like, in Ireland today, there are two fundamental classes. There's those who own most of the means of production, a very small group of people, the Tony O'Reillys, the Michael Smurfits, the shareholders in Anglo-Irish Bank, you know, relatively small group, and there's a vast majority of us who don't have a lot of choice but to either sell our work, sell our ability to work, or try and get by on the dole. You know, sometimes we say, oh, fuck this, I'll go off to the Caribbean because it might be nicer. We don't have the means to do it, you know. Our options are quite limited, and we're the vast majority. They talk about, like, sort of how many classes are there now. Realistically, in Ireland today, there's those two, and that's where the conflict is. There are remnants, I suppose, of earlier classes. Now, there's probably a few outlanded aristocracy somewhere, you know, like, I know, Henry Mount Charles up in Slane, but they're so small a number, it's not worth talking about. It says the real old aristos who never really produced anything, didn't want to, you know, improve the means of production, didn't want to generate more. They just wanted loads of loot coming in that was spent on luxuries for themselves and their families. Practically none of them left. The middle class is probably the most misunderstood idea ever. Like, I remember when I first got involved in politics sort of a few years ago, you used to get people on the left arguing things like, are nurses part of the working class? Are teachers part of the working class? Lunatic fucking stuff. What do they think they were? Members of the ruling class? Yeah, it was fucking absurd. There was this silly idea that, yeah, like plus, unless you had a fat cap and kept pigeons, you know, and only drank Beamish, then you couldn't be a member of the working class. Like, the working class didn't have gin and tonics, or they didn't go to anywhere, you know. No, bullshit, you know. Sort of sociological claptrap, basically. The real middle class, I think, is that group between the two big important classes. And in Ireland today, like, the middle class, it really would be like you're a small shopkeeper, you're a chemist, maybe you're a self-employed professional. But it's a very, very small number of people. Again, you could say most of the long-term interests lie with the vast majority, but their short-term interests don't. You know, it's a bit like, you know, if you're a small shopkeeper just working for yourself, or maybe you employ one person, and you're just sort of getting by okay, and you might be a really nice person, you might think socialism's a great idea for the future, but if the shop up the road halves the wages of the one person they're working for, you're going to have to do exactly the same, or otherwise your prices are going to have to be dearer than them, and you're going to lose all your business and have to close down. But I do, again, I think, like, the middle class, the real sense, sort of, you know, the self-employed or the very, very, very minor employer are a relatively small group. And the other one, I think, that people sometimes warn about is sort of the underclass or the lumpen proletariat, which, like, isn't an insult, like, it's just a description. But again, a tiny, tiny group, like those generally who have been so depressed, usually over several generations, but things like early school leaving, chronic unemployment, no, that you really don't have a lot of hope. You find it very hard to see beyond tomorrow. You have not really much sense of a, you know, collective let's, in any situation, let's get together and improve something. It's more just absolute survival. But again, like, it's a tiny, tiny group of people. Like, at the end of the day, I think it is pretty simple. Like, basically, on one side of the fence, there's, I don't know, 80% of us. There might be about 15% in the middle, in the grey area, and then there's maybe, at the very, very most, 5% were the real ruling class. And I think if you look at things in the conflict between the overwhelming majority and that tiny minority, it probably simplifies it a bit.
I think
you're going to come back on. I just wanted to say, well, first of all, when I was talking about the peasants in Chiapas or the middle class in Argentina, I don't mean that like we should look to them as an example. I just meant that if we're asking the question, how do we know who will struggle? Basically, we don't know. But there's potential there because class is outward, it's a relationship. And it's a relationship which has conflict in it, which always has the potential for conflict, can always be opened up. And so we don't really know who will struggle. And asking the question of, like, how do we encourage people to struggle, or how do we create the conditions for people to struggle? Like, the most oppressed in this country, the poorest people in this country, what you might call the underclass. Do they struggle against the state, against the system? Do they try to change things, or do they more often blame travellers or the blacks or whatever? Like, how do we find people to struggle with, or help to create the conditions where people might struggle.
They create differences between the people. At the moment, we public sector and private sector. Mm. And as you say, the owner class will blame the blacks, or they blame the Trumps. Well, this is all done with the elite. The elite are sending these things down the line, so people can fight amongst themselves, and they'll never be removed. Well, that's what seems to happen in Ireland. Most Ireland is, it's a historical thing. We've been under English litigation for years, and people just gave up on politics. Didn't care, and it seems to have wormed its way through where we did get our freedom, and an elite group did take over. And ever since that day, with parochial politics down the country, one slap you back, you slap me in, these people, sons and daughters and aunties and uncles, have all just got into power. And which is what we've got now, it's just an elite group of people that look after each other. And the rest of us can do it. Our biggest export is our own people. Look at immigration, look at the famine, send the people off. We don't need them. Just leave enough people here to do the work. At the moment, we've got foreigners doing low paid work. The bosses are the only ones making them. They know we can hire the foreign workers at a cheap rate. And all the Irish people can get what you like. Next thing they want to do is take down the minimum wage. For the fact that there's probably no minimum wage in Ireland anymore, either. Don't tell me they're looking after it, they don't care.
I mean, that's a big one to win as well. You haven't spoken yet? Okay, I've been making them qualifying chances.
Yeah, I agree very much what you're saying there about the creating divisions. And like you were talking there about Paul, about how Orthodox Marxism has left a kind of an imprint on our political imagination, so to speak. And I think there's a few comments that people have said here that I think reflect that, and I think that show that this is still a problem for us. You yourself, Paul, in answer to Fergus, is it? In answer to what Fergus was saying about Argentina, you say the middle class, in a situation of crisis, they realise that in fact they're working class. So essentially what you're saying there is that something happens and then they become conscious of some objective conditions, and through consciousness of objective conditions they become the working class. That is Orthodox Marxism. And by saying that their consciousness of themselves as middle class is a kind of a false consciousness, which is basically I think where you're going, you're I think you're falling back on an Orthodox Marxist explanation. And likewise, Finn, you were saying they're peasants, and your response to Fergus again is peasants. Objectively, they're a minority, therefore, out. That's exactly the same way the credit rating industry that Paul talked about sees society. It's like peasants. How much are they? 20%. Now, I happen to agree with you. I don't think peasant struggle is very relevant in Ireland today. But you say it's but you say they're 20%. They're a minority. Therefore, we can forget about them. Now, maybe you're right or wrong in relation to the particular question. But that mentality of categorising society according to some kind of objective characteristics and calling that a class analysis, that's Orthodox Marxism. That's what it is. And likewise, I think the perspective that you put forward, and maybe you'd agree with me, it's an Orthodox Marxist perspective. There's two classes, you're either in one or the other, that's it. So, I mean, I think it's important to... So I think it's really important to recognise the imprint of the Marxist, Orthodox Marxism that Paul criticised, but then to be really, really... really vigilant with that and like not just recognise that here and now, but then really think, how does that, because I think that in the social movements in Ireland, that penetrates into everything we say and everything about how we see the world. And that's why it's really fundamental to have like really like ongoing constant discussions to try and, you know, to basically reflect on that and see if there's other ways of thinking about it that might work out better.
Yeah, you pull the last word.
Yeah.
Didn't actually say that, mate. I just said that the world collapsed, that was all. yeah, I mean, I started this by saying that, you know, in something like social theory, there's no real right answer. The question is this concept a useful one or not? And the only people who can answer that really is yourselves. So it's not... I was reading something in the Financial Times. I see for free online. Today, would someone talk about business, sort of courses I do for business, and they said, I wish I could get through to these managers that that these courses are a process, not an event. And that's kind of what I think these sort of discussion sessions are. They're not an event. You know, they're not going to change your life or whatever, but hopefully with a bit of talking and so on, we'll float a few ideas around that you might be able to pick up later on and put to use. You know, ideas are just tools, really. So the question is, can we put them to use? And I think to come back to the point that a number of people have made is that given we are the majority of society, what really matters is divisions amongst us, you know, Tuppence Haley looking down on Tuppence, so on and so forth. And those really, for me, that's the most useful thing about the idea behind class, is try and get people to think beyond their particular identity or their particular tribe and say, hang on a minute, you know, there's only them up there. And there's all, regardless of how we may feel about, you know, the divisions that are presented to us, we're being played off against each other. And if we actually want to make a change of things instead of just suffering these endless slings and arrows, then we need to do something to transcend those divisions. And I think that's a very useful thing to do that.
Okay, so thank everybody for coming again. This is the first meeting of what we're hoping is going to be a series of meetings every first and third Wednesday of the month here at 6:30. We've got one other plan, definitely, and then sort of loose plans for ones beyond that. And the other thing I'd say, we've a Facebook group that advertises this that I suspect is probably where most people found out about it, because we did not much other promotion. But we can continue some of the discussion online on that tomorrow if anybody actually wants to make any points, either that they weren't comfortable speaking here or they on the way home and they go, damn, I wish I'd said that. Probably be a chance to do it. The next one is going to be called A Revolution in Our Lifetimes. And that asks the question of, are we spending our precious time outside of work at protests and meetings because we want to improve our lives, or are we just fighting for future generations? And that's actually a sort of argument within the WSM that's been going on for quite a while. Alan over there kind of represents one pole of it, probably. Very convincing.
I don't have long to live.
In his lifetime. I normally argue the other one, but we've been having the arguments, I'd say, for about 15 years, and I sort of feel that it's not really fair, because each year goes by, I'm more likely to be on the losing side. But anyway, so the next lesson, 2 weeks' time, here again at 6:30, that's where we're going to be basing it around. And great to see you all here tonight. Hope people enjoyed it. And thanks a lot.
You've been listening to a recording from the Rethinking Revolution discussion series. That was a recording of the discussion that followed the talk, How Do We Know Who Will Struggle? You'll find more recordings from this series on the WSM website at www.wsm.ie. This audio was recorded and edited by Andrew Flood.